Hello, and thank you for listening to our first podcast created by the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries Net Zero Portfolio Working Party. I'm Brandon Horwitz, co-chair of the Working Party and an actuary working in the area of investment governance, including the key area of responsible investment, also known as environmental, social, and governance, or ESG investing. The Net Zero Portfolio Working Party has been established by the IFOA Sustainability Board to produce materials to help actuaries understand net zero investing. Our goal is to help actuaries navigate the many aspects of this important and constantly evolving area, and our output will include papers, podcasts, and potentially an interactive event. Now, there's no better way to understand net zero investing than to speak to people who are already on this journey, so I'm delighted to welcome our guests from Prudential PLC today to share their experience. Kerry Adams-Strump, the Director of Group ESG, and Rulof Kotzia, the Senior Manager Actuarial Function Team. And some of you may know Rulof as the co-chair of the Actuaries Carbon Collaboration. Welcome, Kerry and Rulof.
Thank you, Brandon.
Well, brilliant to have you guys here. Could I ask you, please, to introduce yourselves, tell us a little bit about your roles at Prudential, how you're involved in net zero investing, and you know, perhaps just a bit of an overview of your firm's approach. Should we start with Kerry?
Sure, I'm happy to go first. So I'm Kerry Adams-Strump, and I'm the Director of Group ESG at Prudential PLC. As part of my role over the past 18 months, I've worked with Prudential to develop our ESG framework for our group. Our group has recently refocused the strategy to be focused on our 15 markets in Asia and 8 markets in Africa. And as a result of that, we took the opportunity to revisit our ESG strategy, which we did in the second half of 2020. A key pillar of that strategy is our approach to climate change. And in order to deliver on that, we have really thought about our approach to decarbonisation and an inclusive transition. And to underscore our commitment to that, in the first half of this year, we set a net zero target. And so part of our conversation today, I hope we'll be telling you a bit more about how we did that.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Kerry. And Rulof, a little bit about what you do, please.
Of course. My name's Rulof Kotzia. I'm South African by birth, but I've been working in the UK for quite a while now. Like Brandon said, I'm a senior manager in the group actuarial function. I work there with the actuaries and do things like capital modeling and more technical things. But then I'm also lucky enough to be working on climate scenario testing, which is how I got involved with the net zero target that Kerry referred to earlier. So it's about bringing both the technical side that I have and applying it to this new exciting field where we're hoping to make the world a better place for everybody. I've been with Prudential for a year and a half, and it has been a very exciting place, and we've done some great things. So happy to be talking about those with you today.
Brilliant. No, thank you. Thank you very much. In terms of actually starting right at the top, because you know we'll talk about net zero investing, which for the uninitiated is hopefully getting to a point where the emissions involved or coming from the activities which your portfolio is involved in are balanced by emissions being absorbed. And the big question everyone has is, does net zero investing actually result in a reduction in emissions overall, or does it just move from one person's balance sheet to another one? So very interested if that's the big question we could perhaps start with.
That is a very big question to start with, Brandon. And I think what we're really interested in Prudential is around real world change. And as you say, net zero investing may not always support that. So part of our strategy has been around focusing on engagement with the companies we invest in to understand how they themselves are going to transition out of coal or lower their own emissions. And we tend, wherever possible, to favor that approach over divestment, because divestment, as you've just said, just passes the problem on to somebody else. It might reduce our emissions, but it won't reduce global emissions. So it's far more important to us that we focus on that real world change and work with the companies to reduce. So net zero investing can help for sure, of course, because it sets ambitions and it sets companies on the right track, but it's got to be done in a way that is that really delivers real change.
Brilliant. And you mentioned the idea of an inclusive transition, and you know, I've heard people talk about the idea of a just transition. For people who are not familiar with the concept, is it something you could unpack for us and talk about how it features in your thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really good question, and it's something that's very important to us. When we were setting our ESG strategy and focusing on decarbonizing our portfolio, the other arm of that element of our strategy was around what we've called an inclusive transition. And an inclusive transition and just transition are kind of used interchangeably. And what that means is that as companies decarbonize, as they transition to a lower carbon economy, they do so in a way that supports broader sustainable economic development. So you don't come out of coal and then as a result, lots of people lose their jobs and then the economy more broadly becomes more fragile. And it's particularly important for us because we operate in emerging markets. So we're in 15 markets in Asia, a number of which are still in the emerging and developing phase. And therefore they still do have a reliance on coal. So how they transition is, it's really important for us. It's done in an inclusive and just way, because that serves the broader needs of our customers and stakeholders in that in those markets. So it as we set our net zero strategy, it was very, and our coal policy, it was very much something we had in mind, and we tested ourselves as we set that policy to ensure we were in line with our principles of a just transition.
Makes a lot of sense. And I suppose now turning to the nuts and bolts of your actual investment strategy and how you're moving towards net zero investing, would you be able to outline for us, you know, some of the key steps in the process of how you're getting there, or how you've gotten there, and perhaps, you know, what you might see coming next?
Of course, I'll start, and I'm sure Roelof will be able to jump in as well. So we started thinking about this after we'd set the overall strategy around decarbonisation. We wanted to make sure that we could really deliver on that strategy. And the most obvious way to do so, as you've said, is to transition to net zero, thereby reducing the emissions in your portfolio. So we engaged with the Net Zero Asset Owner Alliance. And as a large insurer, they're the ones that set the rules, if you will, for how asset owners such as ourselves should set a target. So what are the measurement criteria for different categories of investments? So we spoke with them, and through them, we spoke to other insurers who had set net zero targets to understand the considerations that they'd taken into account. We used our own systems to baseline our current emissions and our emissions at the end of 2019. So we knew what was the problem, where were we starting from? And we then projected it out over different scenarios over multiple periods to understand how we could transition that portfolio through different management actions and different policies. For example, we looked at who the highest emitters in our portfolios were in terms of those companies' emissions. And if we were to set a coal policy, for example, what impact that would have. Of course, we had to look more broadly at the impacts on returns and risk limits that we'd have to consider as part of that. So having done all that analysis, we then were able to make a proposal that we believe we could reach net zero by 2050. And also we could, in a shorter term, achieve a 25% reduction by 2025. And we then took that through our executive and board level governance to make sure it had been rigorously reviewed and approved, and that all stakeholder interests had been considered as part of that decision-making. So those were the key steps that led up to our announcement in May this year to set a net zero target.
Yeah. I think Kerry covered really the important big steps. And I think things I'd like to add to that is we set up a multidisciplinary team of asset managers, people who've previously set these kind of policies at other places. And you know, I was lucky enough to be the actuary in the room, or one of the actuaries in the room who could contribute. And having all that different knowledge and experience and viewpoints really helped get this over the line, especially with the scenarios, the feasibility studies that Kerry was talking about. Some people had certain ideas and then we would try and work those out. Other people would have different ideas and we'd try and work those out. And there were definitely, along the ways, there were difficult decisions that had to be made. We had to make certain trade-offs between, you know, practicality, like Kerry said, looking at the limits, the returns that can be achieved, really wanted to align with our ESG strategy about supporting local society to continue to have a just transition. And then there's also the more detailed things like, was the data available to be analyzed? So I think one of the key roles that we as actuaries in this industry can play is explain the uncertainty around these kind of things. So we've set a net zero target for 2050. That's very, very far away. So we had to explain the uncertainty about where the world could go, where industries could go, how industries and sectors could decarbonize, how governments could decarbonize, and how those things could come into play in this. But then what was really useful also about the Net Zero Asset Owner Alliance is that they recommended short-term targets. So we then really kicked the tires on the 2025 target to make sure that through these feasibility studies, we can, with all those uncertainties in the background, really be certain that we will be able to achieve the target that we've set for 2025.
Makes sense. And so you've mentioned the Net Zero Asset Owners Alliance, which is one organization which people may have heard of. Many people may also have heard of the Paris Aligned Investment Initiative, which has published the Net Zero Investment Framework. Is that something which featured at all in your thinking?
Yeah. So there's quite a few of these. There's also the Science-Based Target Initiative, and there's so many acronyms floating about. Kerry mentioned that we spoke to quite a few people at the start, and quite a few of the people we spoke to are members of the Net Zero Asset Owner Alliance. The one key benefit for me personally of that is that it is owned, that it's targeted at asset owners. The others are, so the Science-Based Target Initiative spans many sectors, but has also specific guidance if you're within a sector. So rather than kind of a one size fits all, we found something that really is designed from the ground up to suit the industry that we're in as an asset owner. We also work really closely with the asset manager and Prudential Group called Eastspring. So they are much more familiar with the net zero investment items that you've mentioned there. So Kerry, you can probably relate to or talk more about this, but what really helped about the Net Zero Asset Owner Alliance is also that they recommend that you set a target for engagement. So not just around the carbon footprint of the portfolio. So that really rang true with us internally. And that's why we then went with that one. I can really compliment the members. They were very open to discussions, and it's lovely to have entered a group of like-minded individuals across the industry who's willing to really work and contribute to making the world a better place.
Anything you'd add, Kerry?
I would echo everything Rulof said. And for us, it was important to join that alliance as well to bring in the voice of the emerging markets that we represent. This conversation has historically been more weighted towards European, UK voices. And given in the coming decades, the markets in Asia that we operate in are forecast to be the ones that are most impacted by climate change, we think it's important that that voice is represented at the asset owner alliance level. And so that was in our minds as we decided to join and to set this target as well.
That makes sense. And you've both talked about 2050 targets and 2025 targets, and obviously targets need to involve quantifiable metrics. How did you guys go about selecting the metrics you would actually use to incorporate into those targets?
So there's quite a number of metrics floating about. Some of them are historic, some of them are forward-looking. The two that we settled on is the weighted average carbon intensity and the total carbon footprint. And those dovetail really well in that they both have pros and cons, but by using them for the different purposes, I think we've hit a really sweet spot. The weighted average carbon intensity is essentially the normalized, so the comparable carbon footprint of your assets under management. And what that does by making it comparable is that you can compare a small portfolio of assets, the carbon footprint of that, against a large portfolio of assets without necessarily penalizing the large portfolio. So a larger portfolio tends to have more carbon associated with it just because it's bigger. But by using this normalized metric, this comparable metric, you can actually, you know, do good things in both the small and the large portfolios. So that's where why we use that for setting our carbon reduction target. But as Kerry said at the start, the real aim is to reduce real world emissions to get the total down. And that's why, in line with the Net Zero Asset Alliance, we went with the total carbon footprint for the engagement part of it. So we don't look at normalized, we don't, you know, maybe on company levels, you look at a company that's more efficient versus not efficient. So you can at least compare small companies versus big companies, but you do look at covering the total carbon footprint of the for the engagement, not just a comparable one. There's also other metrics that's worth noting. There's some forward-looking ones that are being developed. So you'll hear about temperature alignment. You'll also hear about, you know, some value at risk metrics. So if we go down different paths as a planet, which assets will do well, which assets won't do well. Some of those are better suited for the asset management side, where you have to do stock picking. As an asset owner, we wanted to look at the portfolio levels. And again, this is where the weighted average carbon intensity and the total carbon footprint really played into its own, so that we could use those.
And I'm sure getting these kind of metrics is quite a specialist activity, and you would have identified some third-party service providers to help you. I wonder if you could talk us through how you approached that and what kind of things you looked for from those service providers, just to, you know, help other people who might be thinking about who they choose to partner with.
Sure. So a key challenge for us, and especially in the 23 countries that we operate in, is getting companies to disclose. So one of the issues when looking at a service provider is how much of those, what level of coverage do they have? How accurate is the carbon data that we are using? And the way that works is, you know, a company in a country either does a climate disclosure, a TCFD report, or it doesn't, or it, you know, its local government requires it to disclose its what's called scope 1 and scope 2 carbon footprint. These data providers then go around and, you know, hoover that up into digestible formats that we can use. And if it's not disclosed, those data providers can estimate a company's footprint based on either similar regions or similar sectors, companies with similar profiles, to give you an estimate of the total carbon footprint of a portfolio. So for us, it was very important to be able to have enough confidence in the underlying data. We have very good internal service providers, so we looked at what they have and went with that. On the, you know, other metrics, also like the scenario testing, et cetera, they have different philosophies, et cetera. So I think, you know, like any good actuary, it's about lifting the hood on these models and on these data and applying our professional standards to those to make sure that we trust the data and that we can explain the models. It's not just a big black box. So, you know, that was a big part of what we did also.
Makes sense. And one final question is, this is clearly not a journey for the faint-hearted. There's a lot of technical detail. There's a lot of stakeholders who you need to satisfy. What were some of the key challenges that you've experienced en route, and you know, how did you overcome them? Maybe some words of wisdom for other people.
I'm not sure about words of wisdom, but happy to sort of share some of our experiences. I think it's the inherent uncertainty of setting a target for something that is 30 years hence. And while as life insurers, and although I'm not an actuary myself, I've worked with them for a long time, we're used to projecting far into the future and making assumptions. You've got to make a lot of assumptions in order to set a net zero target. and you're making a public commitment on that. So doing the work, so making some projections and doing some analysis that gives you as much confidence as possible on those assumptions is key to doing it. I think in terms of how did we get past it, ultimately we felt this is the right thing to do. We recognize the scale of the climate change challenge, and that Prudential, as with all other corporates, should be playing its part in mitigating those effects and making a stand. And that a systemic change is needed. We need the whole system needs to move by 2050. And we wanted to show that we wanted to be part of that change. And if everyone gets on board, corporates and governments, the system will change and we'll be able to achieve those targets. And so by making a public commitment, we really underscored our belief in that stance.
Rudolf, anything to add?
I think we were quite courageous in what we did. I think we, as a group, operate in areas where there is a lot of uncertainty in the data. There's a lot of different characteristics in the countries compared to the likes of the UK or France or Germany. And the targets we've set are ambitious with that in mind. We really had to kick the tires on it, really had to make sure that we can deliver what we've set. But we are confident we will be able to, because we had the multidisciplinary team, we had the expertise in the room, we also had the support of management and executive to make it happen. And that really helped. I think there are some challenges around, guidance and definitions and taxonomy and these kind of things. But as an industry and as a global body that's being addressed, climate change, anybody who's spoken to Louise Pryor, the current president of the IFOA, will know how important that is to her. And it is definitely going to shape our industry in the next 20 years. So for me, any and all actuaries, please get in touch. And I'm also happy to take personal questions if people want to get in touch and have the discussion more closely also. It's better to share these experiences and make the world a better place. So happy to help with that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I think you've both helped unpack quite a complicated and thorny subject in a nice, neat 20-something minutes. So thank you very much for giving us lots to think about. And there's certainly more to come. That's everything for today. But to anyone listening, please do watch the space. There are more podcasts planned. There is other materials coming. And if you'd like to know more about the IFOA sustainability work, just pop onto actuaries.org.uk, search for sustainability board, and you will find a wealth of material, everything from curated reading lists to practical guides on sustainability issues for actuaries working in all sorts of areas, whether you're in DC pensions, life or general insurance. So as Rulof said, there's no shortage of material. Our president is a big fan and certainly very active in this space. So that's all we've got time for today. A really big thank you to Kerry and Rulof. And please do watch this space for more.
Thank you, Brandon.